Welcome, everybody. It's Mind Rolling. I'm back, and I'm back with a very old friend, someone we haven't talked to in quite some time. And you've listened to a podcast that we did, Lama Tsultrum Alioni. Lama, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you.
So great to hang out with you again. Really is. I am blessed to have you and so many of our friends that we've known for all these decades that we met in India all that time ago. It's pretty graceful. So we were just chatting before we got on live here, and I was mentioning that I just came back from a retreat with Ram Dass Krishnas, Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, Trudy Goodman, a whole bunch of us. And I haven't told you this, Lama, but of course, since November 9th, was it? It's like, where were you? It's like, you know, when Kennedy was shot, you remember where you were? When the Twin Towers fell, you remember where you were? So where were you when that cataclysm happened?
Yeah, that was interesting. I was actually hosting an election party at our house with all the people from Tarimandala, all the residents of Tarimandala. I was wearing white, you know, ready to celebrate, and, you know, had been watching the polls and so on for months. And so the first thing that happened to me was we're also listening to NPR. And the very first thing that came on, this was pretty early in the results, but Trump was ahead in the Electoral College. And it looked like by quite a bit. And I thought, well, you know, New York hasn't come in and, you know, so on. And then that kept going. And it was the most sinking feeling. In fact, I'm still sinking, actually. Every new cabinet member, I go a little deeper. Yeah, it's really like, I think we're all a bit in future shock that, you know, didn't really happen, did it? Like, we're going to wake up from this and it'll be just like a weird movie. But it doesn't seem like that's going to happen.
No. Imagine there was close to 400 people at this retreat at this wonderful resort in Maui. Everybody with high expectations of getting into a real beautiful heart space. But there was an underlying chaotic fear and polarization, everything that at every retreat, there isn't one that goes by that we don't talk about. How do we transform our us and themness on a day-to-day relative basis? And then this thing came along and the gigantic prospect of it. And I mentioned to you the theme of the retreat, finding the beloved, touching the compassionate heart. So Ram Dass was, of course, very, very intent on having this all come up and really discussing it and finding ways to, how do we deal with this day-to-day pain? I mean, you're talking about, I mean, I know you're somebody who is very active. You know, there may be people out there who believe, wow, a llama is sitting in the cave and meditating, and you know, this is Maya, this is illusion, but this is not you. I know you. And so maybe talk a little bit about using the tools that you've had for all this and how it's working out for you.
Yeah, well, I am from a family. My father was a journalist and a newspaper publisher. And so I really, the news, you know, I think it's irresponsible. That's how I was raised, not to know what's happening. So I make an effort to know what's happening. Right after the election, we launched a campaign of the eighth Tara. There's 21 Taras, and some are wrathful and some are peaceful and some are joyful. And they each have different capacities. And so the eighth Tara is wrathful, and she works with lawsuits and conflict and all kinds of things like that. And it was when Standing Rock was really big. I mean, I know it still is, but it's in a better place now. So we launched this working with Tara to work with the situation, and we did an internet campaign on our Lama Sultra Malayani Facebook page and Tara Mandala Facebook pages, and a lot of people got involved from all over the world, and we're doing mantras to just, you know, try to see the best possible outcomes and remove obstacles. And so that was really helpful to me, to have that practice as a place to take it, because she's wrathful. And so, you know, the anger that came up for me, and the feeling of powerlessness in the face of what happened, could be transformed into wrathful compassion. And so what does that mean, wrathful compassion? It's energy. You know, the wrathful energy is fast-moving energy. So another way to look at it is it's anger without hatred. So if we think of Kali or something like that, Kali is, you know, it's a fast-moving, intense energy. And so Taras like that, the wrathful Taras, are very powerful. And so it transforms anger into fast-moving compassion. And I think that's important, that we don't limit ourselves to, like, compassion is always smiling and everything's fine. And, you know, the Dalai Lama is also not always like that. We have this image of His Holiness as, you know, always smiling. But I've been with him when he's gotten wrathful and slammed his hand on the table, you know. And it was kind of like, whoa, the Dalai Lama, you know. But it was about something that was really, he felt strongly about it. And he had a wrathful manifestation in the face of it. And so that's something in the Tibetan tradition, that the deities, which are really like archetypes, have different aspects. And I think that's important also for us to, how do we own anger? You know, is it just a forbidden, or can we use it creatively? And I think a lot of the protests that happen, or that energy to even go to a protest or whatever, it comes often out of anger, you know, that you're just fed up. And so that it's a motivator, it's energy. And it's like a mother lioness, you know, or any mother animal or human mother. Somebody attacks her young and she gets wrathful. She manifests. Sometimes she's not even really going to do anything, but she'll manifest that aspect. So that's one way I've been working with that. And it's a powerful practice. Maybe I'll put it up again on the Tara Mandala Facebook page for people that might have missed it, that would want to know the mantra and see what that Tara looks like.
Yeah, and we'll definitely include it on the Be Here Now Network mind rolling page, so people can link to it. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
All we all need all of this and
and whatever we can get.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
The other thing that about that subject that I'm reminded of is when the Chinese invaded Tibet. The Tibetans, of course, most of them realized what was happening and that they were not going to win this battle. And yet they continued to do good, to do their dharma. It was a story of a lama named Changchub Dorje, great Dzogchen Lama. And as he was in Kham, and they came into Kham first. And so he was building stupas. And people said, what's the point of building stupas? They're tearing down all the stupas. And he said, the point is building it. And if it gets torn down, it gets torn down. But just because it's going to be destroyed doesn't mean we don't keep trying. And so that's another way that I've been looking at it. We have to just keep trying. We have to keep going with our ecological initiatives and feminist initiatives and anti-racist initiatives and so on in the face of a big wave of something that is opposing that. And I don't know if we can trust that good will triumph over evil. You know, from a Buddhist point of view, that's not guaranteed. It's samsara, so anything can happen. But for us, we have to keep our motivation as bodhicitta to do everything we do and think everything we think for the benefit of all beings. And so even that upset that we might feel or the anger, it's for the benefit of all beings. You know, it needs to have that motivation. And also, you know, when we speak of wrathful, there isn't attachment. Like, so you're not getting all like, you know, although it's hard not to. I mean, and, you know, for me now, just watching Aleppo and what's happening there, it's very hard to witness these things. And at the same time, we have to witness them. That's our duty. Bearing witness is really part of mindfulness. And not to turn away, because there certainly can be a tendency right now to just like, I just can't take it, you know, to turn away. But that sort of fearless bearing witness, that's what Tara does. That's what Avalokiteshvara does. That's what the Dalai Lama does. And Tara is smiling, you know. And so you can be both empathetic and concerned and bearing witness. And at the same time, smiling. So to keep your inner peace and your inner joy. And at the same time not, you know, turn away. And empathy is really important. So yeah, it's definitely like it's shocking times. And thank you for talking about it because it is important. It's so on our minds and with something like what you do, there could be a tendency to just let's just go into bhakti or bliss and emptiness or something. And we can't do that.
Yeah, no, not at all. And as I said at this retreat, that was so much, of course, on everybody's minds. And how we got into it, actually, particularly with Ram Dass, because he's talked a lot about social action over his many years in that realm. And we talked about anger. And of course, he talks about it. If your heart is full of anger, whatever you're trying to, whatever goal you have, it will not happen if you go into it with that kind of divided heart. And then you were just talking about how anger is certainly a motivator, that energy, just that energy gets you out there to take action on any level. And then I noticed in myself, because this is not big news to people who listen to the podcast, I certainly have a problem with anger. And it's one of the, I mean, many people do, and it's not a unique thing, but I find in this particular situation that that energy pulls in such deep-seated stuff from my past around things that I've been hurt by or whatever it is from my childhood, past, like God knows, that I'm taking all of it, and in this particular instance, I'm throwing it into my anger around what happened in this political process. And that's a difficult thing, and that's you know, I'd like you to talk about how to work with that when and I think everybody does this when that energy comes up, it's pulling.
It all links to all the other ones, all the other anger.
Yep.
Triggers.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of goes into the anger department and then meets all the other
yes
anger demons. Yeah, well, I think on a personal level, there's a way to deal with it in the sense of feeding your demons is really what I would recommend. And also this idea, you know, right now I'm working on this book called Meeting the Mandala. Mm. So the mandala is very present in me. And the Vajra family, which is in the East, is anger. That's what I call the encumbered pattern of anger. And normally these are called the poisons. In Sanskrit, it's kleshas. Mm. In Tibetan, nyumong. But the interesting thing is that in the mandala, our worst thing is also our best thing. Mm. So if you have a lot of anger, you have a tremendous potential of that energy becoming mirror-like wisdom. So when the struggle is removed from the anger, then it becomes mirror-like wisdom. So it's the same energy. It's not like you've got to get rid of anger and then cultivate something else. It's that that energy of anger itself, when the struggle, meaning the dualistic fixation that occurs in anger of me versus whoever I'm mad at or whatever I'm mad at, when that's removed, it's just energy. And that energy has a tremendous amount of clarity. We can be so clear about other people's faults and, you know, what's wrong and so on. So that is, to me, that's a powerful idea that, you know, and it's the same with passion. If you're really passionate and desirous, you know, it from the view of the mandala, that's not a problem. That's energy. And that energy can be then transformed into the wisdom. In that case, it would be the wisdom of discernment. So all the five basic emotions that are in the mandala are worked with through light and through sound and visualization when you're working with a traditional mandala and mantra to move that energy from the fixated, painful struggle of anger into really, like, what is that? What is the energy of anger, actually? What's that like when you feel it? And it has a tremendous amount of clarity. So mirror-like wisdom is very precise. So I imagine you're also very precise in your work, in you know, how you do things in your house and so on. So that quality also, like science and things like that, like Steve Jobs is a perfect example of a Vajra person. Mm. You know, he had this really problematic anger, but he had this amazing precision and intellect, you know, capability. So that, you know, that's something that I would suggest is working with the mandala and with Vajra family particularly to transform anger into wisdom, mirror-like wisdom.
not nothing to transform the duality, though, that we get caught in, the complete polarization, because as soon as you get into that energy, you're lost. And how to just make that leap is very, very difficult. I mean,
yeah, that's why you have to kind of do some preemptive strikes, meaning work with it when it's not really up, so that you begin to become aware of it and transform it.
Nip it in the bud, so to speak. Be able to
awareness. Even before that, like say you're working with anger and feeding your demons when you're not angry, but you recall a situation in which you were, or you work with the seed syllables connected to the Vajra family, and the color and the light and so on, when it's not like sort of dramatically up, and then you have a better chance. That's why we call it practice. Then you have a better chance when it actually does erupt to remember to work with it. And to not just like go down that road, you know, that's so familiar.
Happily.
Yeah. And with lots of self-righteousness.
Yes, yes, yes.
The anger is always self-righteous.
Yeah. By the way, everybody, this is all available in Lama Sultram's book, Feeding Your Demons, which is a fantastic book with, like I say, everybody's got all of these issues in one way or another, one more strongly than another. So I highly recommend you pick that book up for sure. So here's another thing that I found that I wanted you to share with everybody. It's from an article that you wrote. I'm not quite sure if it was just an article or if it part of something else, a teaching. One ground, two paths, two results. And now, when I read it, there is some, shall we say, quote unquote, arcane material in it related to Tibetan Buddhism. And so before we got on, I said to Lama, it'd be great if you kind of turned it inside out a little bit so we could get a grasp. But there's some tremendous stuff in here about the reality of our ground reality. Truth, whatever you want to call it. There's so many different words that you can call it. Luminous light, of course, I like that. And that's when it starts to get it. People go luminous. I'm not quite sure what luminous is and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then describing the second path, which is straying into non-recognition, which you'll explain a little bit. Can you sort of give us a picture? Because I think it's really... It's something great to as a real metaphor for our lives, especially people who've jumped into the spiritual path.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I was just writing about that today for the Meeting the Mandala book.
Oh, great.
So the idea is that there's something called the ground of being. Or just the ground, we call it. And so the ground of being is pure potentiality. It is awake potentiality. It's completely awake. So this is our ground. This is what we come from. We could say this is our mother. So we on some level are already awake. We are already enlightened. We already know our true nature. We are it. It's not that we know it, we are it. And yet we've forgotten it or it's become obscured. Otherwise we'd all be enlightened and there wouldn't be any problems. So this pure potential rises forth or radiates, or you could say even plays. And as it radiates, what it radiates is luminosity or phenomena. So everything around us, if you look around, you know, you're looking at, I'm looking at walls and windows and so on. Everything around me is actually a manifestation of, or the play of, the ground of being. And it is actually light. And so am I. And we know this scientifically, actually. It is. That's what it is. However, what happens when the ground radiates, which is, it's kind of once upon a time, but it's also moment by moment this is happening. So as it plays, or as it expresses itself, as this ground, which is empty and luminous and pure potential, but no form, as it expresses itself, form takes place. And we have color, we have the elements, we have the universe. And so there's the two paths are, one is to recognize that manifestation or those appearances are inseparable from the ground, not separate from it. Or that's path number one, or we fail to recognize that. When we fail to recognize that, we see all this as other, as not me. And as soon as we have that, what we call in Buddhism dualistic fixation, we actually fixate on that separation, there's a feeling of anxiety that arises in us. That anxiety wants to resolve itself, like anxiety and fear always does. We want to get over it. But what happens in the second path is the way we try to get over it is to try to control it, to try to control our world. And we do that through passion, aggression, and ignorance. And so passion would be try to seduce it, like get it closer so it enhances the sense of I, the sense of self. Because when that split happens, this I and others created, and I wants to be safe. Yeah. I wants to protect itself and enhance itself, get bigger, get better, get more famous, more, have more stuff, have more money, have more beauty, have a better whatever. And
Mr. Trump and so, would come to mind then.
Yeah, we could put our name on everything. So everything becomes, we want more of that. And then that enhances the sense of self. Or we are threatened by this other that's out there. And it seems like it wants to harm us or destroy us or somehow make us less or do something negative to us. And so then we develop aggression to deal with that. Or the third option is we get really confused and kind of befuddled. There's a word that's actually, it's kind of a big word, but it's really a good word. It's obfuscation. Yeah. And yeah, I didn't even know what it meant for a long time, but once I looked it up, I was like, yeah, that's it. It's a feeling of obscuredness. And it's almost like you get veils over you. And so it's like, I can't deal with this, I'm going to go to sleep. Or I can't deal with this, I'm getting depressed. And so those three methods become strategies to deal with this basic split from the ground. And so when we practice meditation, what we're doing is we're turning that awareness or that consciousness or our mind that's been going out and grasping, developing all these strategies and then creating all this karma with everybody else because everyone else is in the same fear and trying to establish themselves. And we get all these really complicated plots going on called families and friends and, you know, businesses and so on. And so in meditation, we stop. That's the first thing. We stop physically. Stop. You know, you're when you're meditating, you're not on your phone. You're not talking. You're not on your computer. You're not driving or whatever. So there's the physical stop. And then there's the mind that turns back to look at itself. This turning, and I think this gesture, I don't know if you can see this gesture, but yeah. You know, if we think we've been going out like this, out, 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 and then that turns back. And so this is the energy of the mind turning back on itself. If it can really turn back, it can reunite with a ground being. So that split isn't there. And when that happens, the experience of it is vastness. Vastness, luminosity, and emptiness. And so that emptiness can also create fear again, you know, the non-existence, that I don't exist. But in any case, so that's the idea of one ground, two paths, two results. Is there's one ground, which is the ground of being. The two paths is either recognition or non-recognition of the inseparability from the ground of being. And the result is either liberation through reuniting with the ground or going out and going out and going out, which is what we've been doing for lifetimes. It's not just this life. And so even though we're on that other path, we can always go back because it's here. It's not somewhere else. It's here right now.
Yeah. That's, this all just references what we're going through right now, too. I mean, it's an everyday thing. As you said, this is lifetimes. This particular incident that's going on right now that has put such a collective fear and polarization in us and them. Into all of us to a certain degree, this certainly goes a long way to defining what is possible and what is happening. I want to say one thing because people, I think, will, when they hear emptiness, there's a the people recoil, empty. There's nothing. So it's just all bullshit, nihilistic, nothing? No. And so I always like to share with people, empty of that, you can really get empty of self-interest. Let's start there as some basic understanding of what emptiness is. Because my biggest example that I use all the time is one day, and again, people out there, you've heard this, but you can hear it again. there's no end to hearing this particular story of Ram Dass who. He was just, actually was with Roshi Joe in Halifax, and they were talking about transition, death and dying. And somebody asked, what was your experience of Neem Karoli Baba? And he just went back into being in that moment, and all he could say was, he's just empty. He's just empty. And it was equated with complete love. It was empty of everything but that. So people out there, empty is full. It's not nihilistic. So I just want to, I like to always point that out to people.
Yeah. And another way to talk about emptiness is that things are empty of what they think, what we think they are.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, we think, like now I'm looking at my computer screen and I'm thinking it's a computer screen, but if I really look at what is it, it's metal and it's electronics and so on. And so there isn't actually anything called the computer. I mean, we call it that, but it doesn't have a discrete, it's not a discrete separate entity. It's all these factors that came together and we gave it a name.
Aggregates, yeah.
Yeah, so that's another way to think about emptiness. And the other thing about emptiness, which I think is you touched on, is that when you actually experience emptiness, the way that experience expresses itself is as compassion. Mm. And so if we're looking then at Maharaji, so he's in the experience of emptiness, but how he expresses himself, or how that expresses itself, is as compassion.
Yeah, perfectly said. So there's a little thing also in what I read from One Ground, Two Paths, Two Results. One thing that happens at these retreats as well, sometimes will, you know, the people that were there back in the day with Neem Karoli Baba, with Maharaji, you know, they'll tell stories and so on, and some of them are miraculous in one way or another, and and some people who are there, either there's a few different kinds of reactions. Some of them will be, they'll get it, just like personally I got it when Ram Dass said that. I totally was there with him, and there was complete trust. It was beyond my thinking mind. So some people get that. Other people, oh God, you lucky dog, you got that. And so there's a little of that going on. And then other people just cannot sink into the possibility or reality of quote unquote miracles. And in this article, I don't know if you remember, but you talk about a realized being can manipulate quote unquote material objects. Activities of one who has realized the true nature of reality. And you talk about that it's scientifically, it's scientific knowledge today of how that is a reality for people who have realized themselves to this degree. And of course, you were with Karmapa 16, and I happen to have had darshan of him, met him as well. And we did mention this in the last podcast that we did, but to me there was, when I got close to him, whatever that thing is, and it's a thing, was no different than that thing in Maharaji thing. Those two puppets or whatever of whatever they were, exactly the same. And so I know we are one with that experience for sure. But just for, because people question the reality of that kind of a thing, and you've experienced it yourself many, many times, just maybe give people a little bit more of the detail of what you were saying in the article around the possibilities that exist when a being has no limitation.
We call it magic, but that's because we don't actually understand how things work. And so the reason that these beings can do things that we would call magic, or have what we call siddhis, which means powers, is because they know reality. So I talked before about illusion and being, you know, when we understand emptiness, we understand the emptiness of illusion. And so when you really see how the way we see now is illusion, and then you see how things actually are, then of course you can manipulate them because you're seeing them as they are. So if somebody, I'll give an example of a miracle that I witnessed. There was a lama here named Adzum Pelo Rinpoche, a great lama from Tibet, and he, I had heard he could imprint his hand in stones, and I'd seen photographs of like footprints and handprints, and I'd also seen where he put just a blunt stick into a solid rock wall, like a cliff. So I thought, it would be great to have one of these at Taramandala, because it would make people have faith. You know, like it would really, like when people see miracles, they have faith. And that's really the only reason to perform miracles. And so I asked him, and I gave him a little stone, you know, little square stone. And it had this like kind of frame on it, like naturally, a different color of stone. So I gave it to him, his sister actually. And then a few days passed, and I kind of forgot about it and thought he had forgotten about it. And we went down into the secret meadow to do a certain practice and came back. And on the way back, I thought, I really should have given him a bigger stone, because now he could only like put his thumb or his finger in it. If I gave him a bigger stone, he could have done a whole handprint. And so I actually stopped by the side of the road and I got a bigger stone. And it was really perfect. It was like a, you know, again, it's kind of like a frame. So I got back there and then I said to his sister, Anila, I got a bigger stone. And she said, no, it's not good. You already gave the other one. It's not good to change it now. And so I was like, okay. And then we were having lunch and he kind of went into this altered state. He was actually in an altered state when I got back that day. And when he goes in these altered states, he starts singing poetry in Tibetan. It's all rhyming and it's all Dzogchen. It's just like Dzogchen is the most profound level of teachings in the Tibetan tradition, and it's about the nature of mind. So he's singing and he's really tall. He's about maybe 6'2". And he's big. He once said to me, I'm kind of like a thermos, you know, this big Chinese thermos, you know, really big. And he was kind of rolling back and forth and singing. And we were having lunch and, you know, he was kind of not really eating because he was doing this. And she was like dying to record it because it was so incredible. But he doesn't allow any recording. So anyway, at the end of lunch, he said, it would be good to go and get people who have faith. And so I ran to our kitchen, which at that time was an outdoor kitchen. And I was like, who has faith? Try to guess, like, who has faith? And I said, come. And so, yeah, maybe there were like 20 people or something came. At that time, we had no building, so it was outside. He was sitting in front of the tent. The dishes were still on the table from lunch. But he had the stone that I'd given him in his hands. And so he said, oh, it would be good if people did prostrations. And so people started to do prostrations. And then at a certain point, he just kind of had in his hand, he kind of went like this. And, then he went, hat! And he pressed his thumb into it. And then he kind of looked at it. And then he invited me to look at it, and in fact, his thumb had gone into the stone. It looked like if you had a piece of butter, and you pressed your thumb into it, and you'd see the whirl in the butter. Mm. You'd see the whirl in the stone. Wow. So great. And then other people came to see it, and. And then he said, oh, if Ani Sultram, as he called me Ani Sultram, if Ani Sultram had given me a bigger stone, I would have done my whole hand for him.
Oh, God.
It was so funny. Like, he knew that I'd had that thought.
Yeah.
And then I thought about it for a few more days, and I was like, oh, my God, why didn't I just give him that stone? And finally, I said, Rinpoche, I feel so bad about that. It was such a mistake. And he said, oh, but it's small, so you can carry it around and you can show it to people. But anyway,
beautiful.
My son, you could say, was his mind turned to the Dharma because of that stone.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because he was studying science and he was on a PhD trajectory in microbiology. Hmm. And I showed it to him and he knew scientifically what would have to happen to do that. And it just turned his mind. Hmm. And so I think that's the value of miracles.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when we were with Maharaji every day, you know, it was about, in India, it's called Knower of All Hearts, and knowing stuff that we didn't even know, and then it happened the next day, or stuff like that. We basically shattered our mind. We no longer could depend on that. We lost dependence on that. That was probably one of the biggest things that he would do for us day to day. That's Yeah, that's fantastic. You know, and I'm thinking about over the last, I'd say, several years, I have become so enamored by Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. Just feeling, I never met him, and I'm like, geez, I could have, and you know, whatever, for whatever reason, didn't happen. And I know you've spent time with him. This is personal. Just give me some connectivity to that being. And I'll tell you, most recently, this is maybe a little interesting, I did a podcast around it. We had this whole, actually Krishnadas and I, we had a dialogue around the fact that for books in the West, non-duality was popular. Bhakti, not so much. Books on devotion, forget about it, right? And he was, Krishnadas, you know, he got all incensed about, Jesus, can you imagine that reality? And then he sent me an article. I think it's Dzongsar Rinpoche who wrote it. I think that's his name.
Dzongsar Khyentse.
Dzongsar, yeah. And it's actually part of a series, and it's going to become a book, I believe. And it's To Cry or Not to Cry, something like that. And he just talked about how in his upbringing in Tibet that crying just was not acceptable on any level. I mean, such harsh conditions. His mother, his grandmother, don't cry. And then he was the tulku of a teacher of Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche.
Mm-hmm.
And he was to meet him, and Dilgo Khyentse had not met him before. And he described this meeting, that they got in a car together and drove to a monastery for some ceremony. And the whole way, which was hours, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche wept. And it blew Dzongsar Khyentse Rinpoche's mind.
Mm.
And in the end, actually this came from a comment about this incredible article that somebody, a Westerner, made that went to see him. And she ended up crying because she was late or didn't think she'd make it. And she was there. She couldn't stop crying. She said to him, "What? Why am I crying like this? Why? Mm-hmm. What is going on?" And he said, "It's just a reflection of very, very deep devotion."
Mm-hmm.
And so Krishnadas was sending me this to go, you see, people think that non-duality is about, you know, complete
not feeling
it's bullshit and so on. But anyhow, you actually spent time with him. I'd love to just give me a little bit of something from being with Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche.
Before I do that, I just want to respond to that about tears. When I met Karmapa, not at first, but when I went back after I'd been ordained for a year by him and went and met him again in Rumtek, I could not stop crying. Mm. I mean, it was going on for days, and he kept giving me things like gifts. I'm not like a major crier, you know, and I couldn't stop. And I never really knew what to make of it. And then I was in a teaching once with Chuki Nima Rinpoche. Mm. And somebody started to cry, you know, and in response to just being with him. And he said, you know, normally our normal tears are like urine. But these tears, when you cry from devotion, it's amrita.
Mm.
It's nectar.
Mm.
It's really different kind of tears.
Mm.
So, and you know, devotion is very important in the Tibetan tradition. Guru Yoga is like considered to be the shortest path to enlightenment. And certainly Tibetan Buddhism is extremely complex. You know, I don't think there's any tradition in the world as complex and rich in that sense. And yet you can just bypass all that with Guru Yoga.
Mm.
So, Namke Norbu Rinpoche now, pretty much whatever you ask him, he says, just do Guru Yoga.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
So Kenzie Rinpoche, yeah, I met him in Tashi Jhong, which is in the Kangra Valley near Dharamsala. And he was there to give 3 months of empowerments called the Damnakzo empowerments. It was right when I was trying to decide if I was going to be a nun or not. I'd been back in the States. I'd seen you there and everybody. I've been with Trungpa Rinpoche and really wasn't seeing how I could be a nun in the West. But anyway, so I went there sort of with that question and then received 3 months every single day of empowerments all day. Not one empowerment, but, you know, like, I don't know how many per day there were. And it was actually the first time I heard the word Machik Laptron, because there was a week of her empowerments. But in any case, the thing that struck me about him, first of all, he's very tall, as yeah. you probably know. And I was sitting way in the back because nuns sit behind the monks. Even like a monk that's been ordained for like 3 days and very, you know, erudite nun, which I was not, but even if I had been, I would be behind. So I was way in the back and the lay people were behind me, you know, talking and having tea. And so it was really hard to concentrate. But anyway, so every day he would come by and he would personally bless every single person with the empowerment substances. And what I noticed about him was his smell, how he smelled. He had the most amazing smell. And, you know, Tibetans don't wash a lot. You know, it's really cold in Tibet. They didn't have running water. So in general, they don't smell very good. You know, they smell like they don't wash very much. But anyway, so it was like, you know, I think there's a word called the odor of sanctity. And it was like a perfume with no name. Like you couldn't say, oh, it smells like roses or it smells like cedar or it smells like, you know, jasmine. It wasn't like that. But as soon as you smell the smell, there was this peace that would come over me. And beyond peace, just to almost like put you into samadhi. And of course, you're blessed, you know, putting something on your head, so you have that as well. But, and then he would go, and I could smell it behind him. And I'm sure I've smelled this from other lamas. It gets in their clothes. Like if lamas stay and, you know, sleep here, then I smell it. And it's something that you wouldn't know if you hadn't met him, you know. Of course, you can see photographs and so on, but this was something really unique about him that I was surprised and really struck by.
Wow. That's beautiful. I mean, we had in reality a very similar experience with Maharaji, because he wore that blanket and you'd bow down and your head would be in that blanket. It would smell like a baby's blanket. I mean, that was so unique.
Yeah, so that was his smell.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, that was just a word that you'd use. You know, like, it probably, you know, how babies just smell so pure.
Yeah, right.
And it's not that they're perfumed. It's another kind of... it's just a way to say it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And that's why the clothes, and, you know, I know that you have some little pieces of those blankets, and yeah. some people do. And so the clothes of the Lama or of the Siddha, like Maharaji, that's valuable for the blessing power because it's imbued with that energy.
Yeah, yeah. That's why Ram Dass gives them out at these ceremonies in Maui every year. That's a big part of sort of the closing, well, not closing ceremony, but on the last day, yeah. Oh, man, just, yeah, thinking about him. And mm-hmm. he's so uncompromising too. Just, you know, there's that one book, 100 pieces of advice. I forget the Lama it came from that he commented on. And you think when you die, people are going to be sitting around thinking about you for more than a week or two? You know, take responsibility. Get with the program, you know, in so many words.
You know, the other thing, just another story about Kenzin Rinpoche, it's not my experience, but Tukasana Rinpoche, who's one of my core teachers and a Lama that I rely on now, he was with him for 14 years straight, day and night. He was his attendant and you know, a Lama with him and Vajra Master and Seichin and so on. And he told the story about how Kenzin Rinpoche would teach anyone anything. Anything that they asked for, he would teach it. And it didn't matter if they were like some old lady, you know, from Tibet or some important Lama or some rich patron. He would always see everybody and he would try to teach them. So he was constantly teaching. And so when he got old, Rabdhan Rinpoche and Tukasana Rinpoche were trying to protect him so he wouldn't die, you know, so he wouldn't get sick. And he started seeing people at something like 8 in the morning and then just see them all day and be giving lungs, you know, the oral transmission or empowerments or teaching nonstop. And so they put up a sign outside the door saying no people can visit before 11 or something like that, just trying to give him a little rest time. And so this went on for like a day and 2 days. And then Kenzin Rinpoche said, why isn't anybody coming anymore? And so they said, well, you know, we put up the sign. He said, take it down immediately. And, you know, this is my bodhisattva vow. I have to give whatever is requested. And I'm here for the people. I'm here for anyone. And so he would just teach constantly. And he knew so much that anyone could ask him anything about any different lineage too, because he's Rime, you know, the collection of all the different lineages. So he knew everything and we give it.
True bodhisattva.
Yep.
I mean, that's what they say about Siddha. There is no reason that they're here on earth whatsoever except for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
For all people. Wow. There was sort of a divergement, but not really. He is just like Maharaji. Ram Dass has always called this. This is what human potential really is.
Mm.
And being with these beings just shows that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of at the end of the program. Since we started this whole thing out about the chaos, fear, polarization of what's gone on, how about, do you mind doing just a short few minute meditation exercise that can help us get back in balance so that we aren't prone to the vicissitudes of what's coming at us day to day, as you say, every cabinet selection.
I know. Oh, yeah. Yes. So let's try doing a little practice with the Vajra family, with anger.
Good.
And just something really simple. I know that not everyone's feeling anger, but I think a lot of us have touched on that emotion.
Guaranteed.
I'd like to do this and connect to one of the seed syllables connected to the Vajra family and to the color. And so we could start just maybe close your eyes and come into an awareness of your body, where you're sitting, and just come into presence. And then become aware of anger. And maybe it's something to do with the election. Maybe it's another incident that's happened recently. Anytime when you've just felt that anger coming up, and begin to notice what that feels like in your body. You might feel a tightening. You might feel a heating. And now really intensify that feeling of anger. Make it as strong as you can. Really rage, intense anger. And now we'll sound the seed syllable ha, which is the seed syllable of the Vajra family, and of the Dakinis of the Vajra family, the feminine wisdom beings. Sound ha, and at the same time, visualize or imagine the color blue, and allow the sound and the blue to penetrate the energy of the anger. And just notice what happens through the sound and the color. So again, intensify. Sound it again, sound it all together. The blue light going through your body at the same time. Yeah. So that's a way to work with anger. It's just with the color and the sound.
Yeah, that I've never done that before. working with a mantra and visualizing a color. That was very effective. I guess blue is highly effective for...
It's sound and light.
Hmm.
And this is part of the mandala, teachings of the mandala.
Hmm. Well, when's that book coming out, Lama? Next year sometime?
2018.
Yeah. 2018, the beginning?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, everyone's going to hear about it. That's part of the Be Here Now podcast network and everyone at Mind Rolling. And I want you also, I know you mentioned it before, to talk just a little bit about a very unusual, in that it's not happened before, a Chode conference, which... Feeding the Demons
yeah.
conference.
Yeah, right. So Feeding Your Demons is derived from an ancient practice called Chö. You actually don't say this. It's more like Chu, but it's Chö. Chö. Chö.
Chö.
Chö. Yeah. Anyway, Chö means to sever, and it's to sever attachment. And it's the only lineage in Tibet that comes from a woman. And so this is one of the eight great chariots in terms of the eight great lineages of Tibet, but it's not so well known. And so this year, or we're almost in this year, in 2017, July 12th to 15th at Taramandala in Pagosa Springs, Colorado, is going to be the first conference on Chöd Shijé, which is another lineage connected to it, at Taramandala, and we're bringing people from Mongolia, an amazing woman singer, and also from Bhutan and Tibet, and scholars from all different countries who are all experts in this, but they've never all met together. You know, Tibetan Buddhism is very lineage oriented, so everyone has their lineage. So this is actually bringing together the all those lineages for talks and panels and also teaching. And that will be followed by a week of retreats where different Chöd practices are being taught. So I'm really excited about this, and I wanted to talk about it to all of you. I hope you can come. It's really quite extraordinary. And even if you don't know a lot about Chöd, it's a great place to meet people and to learn about it. So you can look on taramandala.org, taramandala.org, and find information about it and all of our other programs too. So I really want to sort of let people know about this because it's such an extraordinary event. And so
yeah, and that'll all be also on BeHereNowNetwork.com and Mind Rolling. Go to the page, you'll be able to link to Tsultrum's book, this Chöd conference that's happening. And by the way, and I mentioned that, I think I mentioned this off the air. I think I said to you, Lama, that in terms of feeding the demons, which is a scary prospect for some people. So yeah. Lama had a great definition of this. Demons are energy that is blocked in various ways. We can all relate to that, blocked energy. And we all have it. So working with the power of the mind, through imagination, we liberate that blocked energy, and that, and using visualization and imagination, somewhat like the little meditation practice that Lama just took us through, and that will give you a central idea of certainly a very basic idea in layman's terms of what will take place. So give me the date again.
July 12th to 15th.
Okay, great.
The summer, and then the retreat week goes until the 24th. And registration for that's open now.
Oh, okay. So we encourage everybody, And you can get the book, Feeding the Demons, and we'll have a link on the page for that as well. And of course, go to taramandala.org and get to be able to connect with all of the teachings of Lama Tsultra Malioni. And one big thing we're not even mentioning, for God's sake, I'll do it in a I'll do an intro to this podcast and mention it, but I'm going to mention it here again. Lama is going to be with us May 3rd through 8th in Maui with Ram Dass and Krishna Dass. And here's something you don't know. Sharon Salzberg's going to join us as well. How about
nice.
That? So it's going to be quite a fantastic retreat. Yeah. That registration will be open the first week of the turn of the year in January. So you'll take a look at all of that. And thank you so much, as usual. Spend time with you is a joy, Lama.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to May and being together. I hope as many of you as can who are listening will be there. I'm just looking forward to being with Ram Dass and Krishna Dass. We're all, old, deep friends, and just precious, so precious to have time with Ram Dass.
Mm.
So,
yes, very much.
Yeah.
Well, we look forward. This is Mind Rolling, and happy to have you all aboard, and we'll see you next week on the Be Here Now Network.